You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 86, Cultural Effects on the Brain and Mental Disorders.
So Jim, have you ever noticed how people in different cultures seem to think differently?
I have. I lived in China for a bit, and it took me a while to figure out that I was being way too direct and individualistic. I think I stepped on a lot of feelings, or I broke their collective brain harmony or something over there.
Yeah, you might have caused a cultural neural ripple or something. But Seriously, I'm sure as you would have probably appreciated while you were there, neuroscience is actually showing that culture literally shapes our brains, not just how we act, but how we also perceive, think, and even experience mental health.
I actually don't know that. I know that psychologically culture makes a difference, but I didn't know that we had any ways that we could measure, like there are measurable differences between brains in different cultures. So
For sure. Like a
Canadian brain, like you can't put a random person in a brain scanner and tell whether they're a Canadian or a Chinese brain, can you?
I think that's a little maybe beyond what we're the capabilities. I don't think we have that level of fine analysis, but I think you can see certainly how different cultures might react to various cues. You might be able to do that predictive.
Or if you had a whole bunch of Chinese brains and a whole bunch of Canadian brains,
yeah,
you might be able to find systematic differences between the groups.
For sure, to like certain emotional tasks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So this is a part of a growing field called cultural neuroscience, and it's essentially, as you can imagine, how cultural environments interact with our biology or our brain to shape the structure and function of the brain, and therefore, of course, as we all said, it can influence all kinds of different abilities.
Okay, I can't wait. So let's get into some examples here. So what kind of differences are we talking about?
Well, let's start with how we see ourselves. And this is something that you probably really understood as you were living in China. So in Western cultures, which tends to value more individualism, brain imaging actually shows more activity in the medial prefrontal cortex when people think about themselves.
That's sort of the self-representation me part of the brain, right?
That's right. But in East Asian cultures, so where you were in China and Japan and etc., these are more of a collectivist. And that same area lights up not just for the self, but also for close family members. So it's like the brain merges me with we, which is pretty cool.
So, it suggests the sense of self is like literally different in a brain from a different culture. That's crazy.
Yeah, and it is. And there's more. So people from Western cultures tend to focus on objects, while those in East Asian cultures tend to focus more on the context or the background, even when they're looking at images.
Right. So if I might say, look at the car, and someone from Japan might say, look at the road with the car in it and describe the general scene.
Exactly. We tend to pick out the most dominant object, whereas folks from Asian cultures or East Asian cultures tend to look at the larger scene. And fMRI studies actually show different brain activation patterns. So this exactly answers your question earlier. So Western participants show more activity in object processing areas, like the inferior parietal lobule, while East Asian participants activate areas linked to context processing, like the posterior superior temporal sulcus.
All right. And this scene versus object thing, you can hear more about in episode 49, where I interview Richard Nesbitt. How about mental health? Does culture affect how disorders might show up or manifest or something like that?
For sure. Big time. And that's something that, I teach courses on introduction to neuroscience and psychiatric disease. I used to teach intro psych. And this is always something that super interested me when I was doing the research for my lectures and looking at how culture influences not only the emergence of these disorders, but how they're experienced across culture. And it's really important that we provide that kind of education to our students. As you mentioned, we really need to make sure that we're not having a white Western approach just to the teaching of psychiatric disorders. But let's start with depression. Obviously, that's one that's quite common in Western cultures. People will report a lot of emotional symptoms that are associated with depression. Like they'll say, I feel sad, I feel guilty, I feel hopeless. So they'll use those kinds of terms to describe what it feels like to be depressed. But in East Asian cultures, depression shows up in a more of like a bodily, physical symptom. So they'll say they feel tired, they might have headaches, or they may literally say that their body feels heavy.
But we know it's depression because it's like treated similarly, or how do we have the same disease though?
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's an interesting point because there's no real biomarker for depression yet. I mean, there are definitely unique brain signatures that are associated with depression, but we know that the treatment of these disorders using classical antidepressants, things like SSRIs or psychotherapy, are to some extent beneficial.
Okay. So it might be a similar underlying disease, but their constant experience of it emphasizes a different things. That's really cool.
Exactly. And stigma is really important in this space as well. So in some cultures, it's more acceptable to say my body hurts, right? Rather than I feel sad. And this experience, there's actually a fancy word for it. It's called somatization. So soma comes from the Latin word for body. And when we somatize our symptoms, so we, even experiences of anxiety, you can feel it in your gut, right? You have butterflies in your stomach. So you might just say, my stomach's upset, as opposed to, I feel anxious. So the different uses of how we describe these experiences is really important in mental health diagnostics.
You know, it's interesting because I'm reading a lot about spirituality stuff, and a lot of the Vipassana meditation stuff seems to be trying to get Westerners to be more, to have more somatization.
Oh, but interesting.
Trying to like, where do you feel the anger? Or where in your body is it manifest? And for me, it's very, very hard.
Yeah.
Like sometimes I'll get something in the gut, but like for the most part, it's just a feeling, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, but you know, they have you focus on your body and try to, you know, become more
in tune.
Yeah, because I guess the idea is like once you can sort of locate it in your body, there are different mental things you can do with it. So it's interesting that, you know, in Asian cultures, it comes to them more naturally. That's really great.
And I think also in Western cultures, when we look at genders as well, because I think it's also more acceptable for a woman to say, I feel sad versus a man. So men may be more likely to somatize than women.
That would be really, I don't know of any studies of that, but that would be really neat if that were, I mean, it makes sense given the cultural expectations.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's, how about some more severe disorders like, say, schizophrenia?
Yeah, great question. So I don't know if you've heard of a scholar by the name of Tanya Luhrmann.
Oh, yeah.
At Stanford?
I know a lot about her work as you know, religion and voices in the head and all that.
Oh, right. Of course. Yes. She's found that people with schizophrenia in the U.S. often hear, as you know, this is kind of what's also played out in the media, is that the voices in the head tend to be harsh. They often command voices. They're threatening. They might say, you know, this is when it gets kind of scary. Like they might ask, you know, harm yourself or harm others. It's quite rare. But in India and Ghana in particular, the voices are actually more friendly and playful. And in fact, sometimes they're considered to be the voices of ancestors or spirits.
Yeah. There are also interesting parallel findings with imaginary companions, imaginary friends and children.
Different
expectations of what those things are. Are they demons? Are they ancestors? Are they just imagination?
Yeah.
Causes children to shut up sometimes and go dark about them or whatever. So it's interesting how the symptomatology changes with stigma and expectation and that kind
of thing. Exactly. And also, as you say, as you're probably alluding to, like these cultures in Ghana and India tend to be more of a spiritual focus in lots of, like, it's a polytheistic culture, right? That you have that kind of probably explains the nature of these.
It's great. Culture shapes how hallucinations are experienced. You know, another example is sleep paralysis, where people so basically sleep paralysis is when you wake up terrified and you feel malevolent figures and you can't move and a couple other symptoms. But the nature of these malevolent figures tends to be culturally informed.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe in demons, they show up as demons. If you believe in aliens, they show up as aliens.
And, yeah. There's, isn't it in Newfoundland, it's like the old hag?
There's like every culture has its own thing. Like every culture has some like, and this is part of this theory of religion where like it fills in what's mysterious. It comes up with an explanation within the, you know, context of the religion. Yeah. But, you know, what happens is that people experience these things and they see it as evidence of what they believe. This proves demons are real. This proves demons are real, you know, and not your religion, my religion, because I saw it.
It's wild, eh? So beliefs and culture shape not just our behaviors, but also core experiences and mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And the same brain disorder, as you're even saying with sleep paralysis, can manifest very differently.
All right, let's hear about some other disorders.
Okay, so eating disorders.
Okay.
So that's one that has been primarily shaped by culture and in interesting ways up until probably the 1980s, 1990s with globalization. So in Western cultures, especially in North America and Europe, anorexia tends to be tied to body image concerns and was actually primarily restricted to North American countries where it's this desire to be thinner, to meet a certain beauty standard. And this really emerged with Wallace Simpson. Do you know who Wallace Simpson?
No, I don't.
No. Was the woman Edward VII abdicated the throne for. She was an American divorcee. And she apparently coined the phrase, you can never be too rich or too thin. So this was in the turn of the century, 1920s, 1930s. And that was sort of demarcated a really interesting time in history where to be thin was very much valued.
Right. Episode 68 on eating disorders and minding the brain, if you want to hear more about that, I think primarily from a Western point of view. The Western cultures and rich cultures in particular tend to have this sort of thin is in thing all the time, but it does vary with depression. And
that's right, because if you're in an economic downturn, to be thin is actually suggests that you don't have enough money to support your nutrition, right? So when the economy is, I think, in a decline, women's body shape preferences actually increase slightly.
They do. Do you know about the Playboy model study?
No.
So when there's an economic downturn, the measurements of Playboy models change. They get measurably, like you can graph it. It like
seriously,
follows the economy.
That's super cool. We'll have to put that in our.
And in fact, if men are hungry, they think heavier women are more attractive.
Fascinating. We are all influenced.
But tell me about the way in other cultures.
Yeah. So in non-Western cultures, like parts of China and Africa, people can experience anorexia without any body dissatisfaction, which I didn't know until I was doing research for this episode.
Wow.
So the food refusal might be tied to emotional distress, religious fasting, or even spiritual beliefs, and not a desire to lose weight.
Well, again, it's like, how do we know it's anorexia? But I guess it's like, you know, they get dangerously thin and start having other problems.
Yeah,
it's not about body image. It could be about all kinds of stuff, different things.
Yeah. So for example, in Hong Kong, some patients with anorexia have said that they've lost their appetite due to this, to stress or emotional pain, and not because they wanted to be thin. So the underlying cause of the experience of the disorder are different, even though the behavior or food restriction is the same.
Wow.
So it's
so important to know for diagnosis and treatment. And, I don't know. Are therapists and psychiatrists trained in cross-cultural?
Some are.
But it's not necessarily standard in all the schools or whatever, right?
For sure. And
if you're treating somebody from a different culture, you could just get it completely wrong.
That's right. And look at like even university campuses that tend to be quite culturally diverse. and look at the significant rise in eating disorders lately. So I think there's even more demand to have some cultural sensitivity around acknowledging how somebody's experiencing an eating disorder, and even also different treatment approaches, which is, again, a whole other background.
Right, because then, yeah, we could do a whole episode probably on the different treatments of people from other cultures.
Yeah, and clinicians might misdiagnose, misunderstand, right? Somebody, especially if you don't, because in the DSM-5, it actually is written that one of the criteria is a desire to lose weight, right? And it's tied to body image. So you can imagine that if somebody comes, like, here, you know, on one of our campuses, doesn't indicate any of that, they might not think it's an eating disorder, right?
Yeah, okay. All right, we have depression, schizophrenia, eating disorders. How about a common one, and getting more common on college campuses, anxiety? How does that show up differently too?
Oh, yes. So in Western cultures, social anxiety disorder is typically about fearing judgment or embarrassment. So I go to a party, everybody's staring at me because I'm saying stupid things. You're worrying people are watching you, criticizing you, thinking you said something dumb. It's all this manifestation of, it's me, I'm looking stupid, right? Yeah.
That's like every Zoom meeting I've ever attended.
Yeah. Especially on Zoom, where it's like you have so much forced eye contact, right? And you're just, you feel that much more on spotlight. So you can imagine how terrible it would be for somebody with social anxiety. Anyway, in Japan and Korea, there's a similar disorder called, and I apologies about the pronunciation of this, but Taijin Kyofushu, or TKS. And it's also somewhat social anxiety, but instead of fearing of you being judged, it's people fear offending or disturbing others.
Okay, so it's not, I'm afraid they'll think I'm weird. It's, I'm afraid I'm going to make them uncomfortable.
Yeah, and you can imagine with that collectivist nature, why that would be the case, right? So people with TKS worry their gaze, their facial expressions, or even their body odor will make others uneasy. And it's tied to those collectivist values where maintaining group harmony is more important than individual feelings, right? So you can imagine if you think somebody is offended by you, it's going to drive your anxiety. And imagine being on a crowded bus or something and you've just gone for a run and you're all sweaty. Yeah.
It totally flips the direction. And like the theme of this so far seems to me like about individualism, you know, it's like, it's all about me. People are looking at me and people care about what I think and as opposed to, you know, what about others.
It'd be interesting to have somebody from a Western culture go, who has social anxiety disorder, go into an East Asian culture party or something, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that could help them. No one cares what you think.
If they knew that, yeah.
I don't know.
So it's what, instead of what do they think of me, it's more like, how am I affecting them?
Yeah. And it shows how culture shapes not only what we fear, but why we fear it. The brain circuitry might be similar. So we know that there's hyperactivity in areas of the brain that are involved in social evaluation, parts of the prefrontal cortex. But the cognitive framing is totally different, which is wild, right? So it's similar brain activation, but how you're interpreting that is different. And it reminds me of, like, sometimes people, one of the ways in which you can deal with anxiety is you're interpreting the nervousness in your stomach. Instead of it being anxious, you're like, I'm super excited, right? So it's the same feeling, but how you cognitively frame it can influence the circuit, which is cool.
Yeah. So I think a lot of what we're seeing is that they're not really different diseases, but the expression and experience of them is different and depends on the cultural context.
Yeah, exactly. You're catching on. So culture doesn't just influence our behavior. It actually sculpts our brain's response to the world. And have you ever heard of something called amok?
Yeah, like run amok.
Yeah.
Did you know the famous cartoon Duck Amok about Bugs Bunny?
No, I've never heard of this. There's a cartoon called Duck Amok.
Duck Amok.
Duck Amok.
It's about Daffy Duck, I think.
Yeah, I never, and again, until I did the research on this episode, I never knew that this is actually a Malaysian word, amok.
Okay.
Yeah. And in Malaysia and the Philippines, when people experience sudden violent outbursts, followed by exhaustion or amnesia. And this is thought to be linked to spiritual beliefs an intense stress, and that is called amok.
Amok, yes. And it tends to happen to young men who are financially really hurting. And it also involves stealing small things.
Wow.
So it's almost like it's a culturally acceptable way to go a little crazy and gather some resources for yourself.
Wild.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, okay, so now we're moving into, you know, an area where there's a complete disorder that basically doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Right? But so before we were talking about like, okay, depression manifests differently, but here it's like, okay, there's no amok in the DSM, is there?
No. There's a section. Oh, look,
she's got it right on her shelf. I'm at Staples. I can't just turn around and grab the DSM.
I have the DSM in my office, and I'm pretty sure, like with every condition, they have like culture-related diagnostic issues. You can see here, right?
Very nice.
So they do have a section there, but I don't think, I mean, I could be wrong. Sometimes I'm wrong, that there's a whole section on different disorders outside of, yeah, I'll have to take a look.
Yeah, it reminds me of like how different cultures have different emotion words that we sometimes only vaguely have a grasp of, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, and is it that they have different emotions, or is it that they just break up the world differently like colors? So anyway, how about trauma?
Yes, so trauma is... Pardon?
Do people experience trauma differently in different cultures?
Yes, they do. And in fact, one example is some indigenous peoples in North America experience what's called ghost sickness. So it's PTSD-like symptoms that are believed to be caused by spirits of the dead. And again, you can imagine in indigenous cultures, there is a greater emphasis. Well, it's like a very grounded in spirituality and ancestors informing people's decision making. And in similarly, Cambodian refugees report that their PTSD-like symptoms are caused by angry spirits seeking revenge.
So we might call it PTSD, but they might see it as a spiritual distress or harassment or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that shapes treatment. Right? Why would you know, how, can you imagine somebody who's experiencing this form of spiritual distress? Somebody saying, oh, well, you just need to like stop thinking about the trauma, or, you know what I mean? That's not necessarily how PTSD is treated, but we have to have cultural sensitivity. A Western approach might involve therapy or medication, but in other cultures, spiritual healing or community might be more effective.
Right. And this is also part of a theme I mentioned earlier about how religion comes in, steps in and tries to explain mysterious things. Mental illness, it's all over the place. You know, like people with schizotypal personality disorder or schizophrenia, temporal lobe epilepsy, often this is interpreted by a culture in a religious context, that you're having divine visions or something like that. So I've heard of hikikomori. That's a cultural thing, right? Do you know anything about that?
Yes, it's experienced in Japan, and some people, mostly young men, withdraw from society, staying in their rooms for months or years, similar to agoraphobia, which is fear people who fear of going out in open spaces. Yeah. Agora, the word for market in Greek. But it's tied to cultural pressures like intense academic or social expectations. And you can see that in Japan in particular, there's a huge emphasis on academic success. And this is well known that there's a lot of pressure on parents for their kids, for them to be, to succeed academically. And so hikikomori might be a response to that academic pressure, where they refuse to come out of your room. And then have you heard of Koro syndrome?
No.
Koro syndrome. So that is another one also found in the East, Southeast Asia, characterized by intense anxiety and fear about inadequate masculinity. It also is a fear that your genitals will retract into your body.
Legit.
And it could actually become like an epidemic. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do other cultures have their own version of the DSM, or do they just translate that one made in English? Do you have any idea?
I think there's the WHO, the World Health Organization, has
has its own something?
Yeah, the other classification syndrome, which I think maybe has more cultural sensitivity.
Yeah, interesting.
Attached to it. Yeah, because DSM is very, it's published by the American Psychiatric Association.
So it's probably, who considers this hikikomori like a real mental disorder, if anyone?
Called KORO. Yeah, it's called the International Classification, the ICD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it is recognized there.
As a mental health disorder, okay.
Yeah.
Is it like still debated, or is it like something that?
No, it's there. Yeah.
Okay.
That's in the ICD-10, International Classification of Diseases.
Okay. So how does this affect treatment?
So culture? Yeah. I mean, yeah. Therapists, like we've sort of addressed it a little bit, are certainly moving towards culturally sensitive care.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine in certain countries, this is more relevant. In Canada, we live in a cultural mosaic versus the US, it's a cultural melting pot. But certainly cultural sensitive care involves, for example, like cognitive behavioral therapy, which is considered a gold standard for a lot of things like anxiety and depression, might be adapted to collectivist cultures to focus on family and community roles, not just the individual. So that's one example.
And how about medication? Do its effects, are they mediated by culture?
Yeah, and you know, it also relates to expectation. We know that expectation of how medicine is going to act will influence your response to some extent. So genetics, beliefs, expectations play a role. In some cultures, there's actually more hesitancy around taking psychiatric meds, mm-hmm. or different expectations about how quickly they should work. So there's lots of things that, you know, we need to be mindful of, because if people are suffering, our approach to how we treat them is really, really important.
Okay, so to sum up, I guess culture, it does shape our brains in measurable ways, and from how we see ourselves and others and how we experience illness and how we heal, and sometimes can even have the generation of different diseases altogether.
Mm-hmm. And culture and neuroscience are inseparable. As a neuroscientist, we know that the brain is the organ of the mind. And so, of course, all these external influences, so things like culture, as mm-hmm. well as society, as well as gender, all, you know, everything is shaped by our environment. And in turn, it helps also create the cultural world that we live in.
So I'm wondering now what my brain would have looked like if I'd grown up somewhere completely different.
Probably just as obsessed with bad puns. Something universal, Jim.
Touché.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and The Frontal Lobe, allowing the planning necessary to pull off podcast production. No frontal lobes were harmed in the making of this episode. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain, and you can find us on YouTube at Minding the Brain Podcast. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.